Welcome to Metacast. I'm Josh Anderson.
And I'm Bob Galen. Good morning.
How are you, Bob?
I'm doing great, Josh.
Okay, good.
Yeah, I'm pretty perky this morning. I got up early and...
That's almost dangerous.
It is dangerous. I've had more than my share of coffee. And we were having some spirited discussion before the Metacast about a variety of topics, which was kind of cool.
Yeah, so we're going to bring that in. We are going to channel that, and we're going to talk about hiring for agile teams. Do's and don'ts, ideas, don't do's, do do's, things like that. So we'll get started. So I've been doing a lot of hiring lately.
I've heard that.
Yeah?
Yeah. That's a good thing, right? Growth.
Yes.
Business growth is a wonderful thing.
It is. It's exciting. It's fun. And it's always a challenge trying to find that right puzzle piece, right? Because the way I view the team is it's a big puzzle, and you've got that one hole, right? You got to find that one person that fits in there just right and kind of bring it all together. So to me, that's really the biggest part, is trying to find somebody that's going to merge and gel and help your team grow. That's a huge part of what I look for when I try and hire somebody, is how are they going to make us better? Right? I don't want to bring somebody in that's just kind of going to toe the party line and say, yep, that's how we do it. We're going to keep doing that way for the next decade, and away we go, and ho-hum.
Yeah. I mean, you were actually making sound. So I thought we were going to be really, and we were kidding before the Metacast about that we debate things, and I said, oh, this is going to be one of those topics where we generally agree, and you just... I mean, I had exactly. I'm like, you stepped in it. From my point of view, I'm like, oh, now I want to jump in and disagree with Josh immediately. I can't even help myself. It's just like it's part of me. But you said fit in, and I know you. Then you kind of recovered, but
I recovered.
But I think. Well, I use the term disruptive, so I'd like to hear your sort of reaction to it. I think we need to find disruptive folks, and what I mean by that is not hire the same. Mm-hmm. We were talking about this before the Metacast a little bit. I think a huge mistake that a lot of teams make is they hire like mirror. Potentially, you can hire mirror images.
Yeah, it's very easy.
Because it's easy to do that. And I'm not saying mirror images. I'm not talking about incompetent people. I'm talking about incredibly competent people. But they're comfortable hires, meaning they look like your team. They smell like your team. They feel like your team. They don't say anything out of bounds, right? They toe the party line, which is what you said. I like to not hire that. I like to actually go for folks who, you know, if we have a team that's doing Scrum and very light XP practices, let's say, and we're not committed to TDD, we're not committed to unit test, I want to go out and find the best unit test, the most loudmouth, opinionated. I mean, I still want him or her to fit into the team.
Right, so it's a balance.
It's a balance, yeah. Right.
So, but I think you also have... Depending on where your teams are at is going to depend, to me, on the volatility that you bring with each hire. If you have a team that's good, you're trying to get to great, I don't think you're going to hire as volatile a personality as if you're trying to get just to good.
See, I'm going to...
You're saying always go...
Not always. Always sounds so complete, but, I mean, right now, I've been spending the last year or so, and it's hard for us. So we were looking for, like, by and large, we were looking for ourselves from an interviewing perspective. And we want to get from, let's say, moderate to good, moderately good, we want to get to great. I aspire to us being a great agile environment and a great set of agile teams. And so it's the speed at which, you're right, there's introduction speed, but there's also what, acceleration speed at the back end of how are we delivering from a business point of view.
Right.
And I've probably stretched the envelope. I've hired some folks that, and we've actually, from a management point of view, it's been very challenging because we've plopped people in the team that the team is struggling with.
Right.
Right.
Is it a good struggle or a bad struggle?
It goes both ways. Yeah. It's something we've had to stick our nose in the team and really provide some leadership and guidance. We swapped some people around in teams just recently because of that. They were struggling in one team, and these are mostly new hires. We moved them to another team where they're actually excelling. But we did some team movement where we normally wouldn't do that.
Right.
So I agree with you that it's a balancing act, but I think we have a responsibility to be pretty darn aggressive.
Right. And while I may have chosen a few words poorly.
Yeah. I'm jumping on your words. We haven't been together for a while. So I'm like a buzzard circling your words. I need to just perch. I need to get on my perch and shut up a bit.
Buzzard Bob. I kind of like that.
Yeah, that may stick.
Yeah, so So that's something I've been telling all the people that I hire lately is, I'm not hiring you to come in here and just kind of join the team. I am hiring you to help me make a change, right? I don't want them to come in and have it be the status quo. I want them to challenge and bring new ideas, but I also don't want them to be, these are my ideas, your ideas stink because whatever, right? Absolutely. Because they're not my ideas, right? So they have to be a team player.
Correct.
But I do want them to come in and right out of the gate start to challenge people. And that's the first thing I mentioned to my teams, and especially my team leads, is I am hiring these people because I think they can make us better. I think they can make us stretch, and growth and stretching can be painful at times, yeah. Right? But be responsive to the hiring, be responsive to their ideas, welcome them, and challenge them also, right? So I'm trying to foster that dialogue and debate within the team that's going to help them get from good to great.
You and I are, it's odd, and we don't always talk offline. We're both incredibly busy in our personal and professional lives, and so we struggle to get together for the Medicast, but we're very much alike in some, and we debate things, but I'm doing exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
In my interview, I have that what I call the Bob Galen, like, jump up on a box, the soapbox pitch,
yeah.
Which is part pleading, part demanding that I want you to make a difference when you right. come in here. It's actually the parting shot that I give to candidates before they leave, so as part of our interview sequence. It's the parting shot. I actually demand, I'm like, don't come here if you're not, you know, one of your decision criteria should be don't take this job if you're not willing to come here and make a difference.
Right.
And I see that potential in you, but don't even show up. And then I have a checkpoint meeting like about a month or 2 months in where we actually grade informally.
Right.
But we sit down and we talk about, you know, what have you done? Particularly from a disruption, not from a work production point of view, but just how disruptive have you been? What differences have you made? And was it good enough? And have you met the challenge that I gave you in the interview process? So it's funny that you, I think it sounds like you and I are doing very much the same thing.
I also try and paint a very real picture for them of what they're up against, right? So if I'm going to bring them into a team that's rocking and rolling, I'll say, hey, you're in a team that's rocking and rolling, and the challenge for you is that really hard part of getting them to really excel and get out of their groove and become something even better. Or if I'm bringing them into a team where they're struggling a little bit, I'll say, this is what you've got. This is what we need to work on. How can you make that happen? What have you done to solve those issues or things like that? So, because the last thing I want is I don't want them coming into my office or my cube a couple months later saying, hey, this isn't what you told me it was going to
exactly.
be, guy. Right?
Exactly.
So that's because I want these people to be here long term, right? And I want them to be happy and work on growth with their team and themselves and all that stuff. And the last thing I want is they think, when I first met you, you lied to me or you hid some things from
exactly.
me, right? So that's falling in that agile and transparency thing. I want people to know what they're stepping in, right? Because
I've always historically done that. So I've been one. And I'm not saying it's a good style or bad. For me, it's worked for over years of leading. I've always had a style of like full disclosure when it comes to the challenges. I want folks to decide not to come based on if you don't have the moxie. It's not that I don't want to hire good folks, but I want them to come in, to your point, eyes wide open. I paint an accurate picture. It's not a pessimistic or an optimistic.
Right.
This is where we are, and this is where you're going to fit, and this is what I expect. So that was pre-agile. I think that's a relevant technique no matter what environment you're in. Now in post-agile, I think it's even more relevant, right? Because the cycle times are so much. It's not cycle, but I mean you're iterating. There's discovery. It's not the pace. I think of agile as from a teaming perspective, your team dynamics are accelerated even more than what it's not a software delivery. So you think of agile as being delivering software faster.
Right.
And it really doesn't necessarily do that. It just delivers chunks, you know, just in measured chunks. But I think your learnings from a team perspective, don't they accelerate from your point of view?
Yeah, if you have those mini cycles, right?
If you have a curmudgeon, right? You know, in waterfall, a curmudgeon can hide, right?
Right, exactly.
In agile,
every 2 weeks.
Every 2 weeks, I have to look the curmudgeon in the eye. It's like, and we have to do something about it. It's unignorable, right? So, and then that curmudgeon, if you're coaching them, every 2 weeks or every day, you're seeing, is my coaching taking effect? Is my, you know, are they trying to adjust? Are they listening? Are they adapting to their team? So you get that. It's something I don't think about often. It's just hitting me now. But from a teaming perspective, Agile is this sort of rich acceleration lab from a team behavior point of view. If you do it, you're what we're doing, talking about, which is pushing people, right?
So we kind of talked about the big picture things. What are some of the small picture things that when you're talking to somebody or you look on a resume or whatever that you say, that's what I'm looking for? Is it something you find on a resume or is it something you get in a quick phone screen? What are some of the quick hits that you're like, yeah, that's somebody I want to talk to more?
I'm not big, and I'll have a short answer this time and then give you, I promise. But I read the paper. I'm looking for some Agile experience. And then we use phone screens, and I don't do them very often. I like even in my phone screens personally. So the managers that report to me do phone screens, and it's really a health check. It's really a sanity check. We're not, and it's mostly on the technology side, we reserve the important bits for face-to-face communication.
Right.
So even for me, when I do a phone screen, I have these what I call coffee phone screens, where I'll meet people at coffee shops because I want to touch and feel someone. I want to see their reactions. I mean, to me, that's that collaborative nature. So I think an emphasis point for me is to not overreact to paper or phone data, and use it as maybe a technology sanity check. But I think you want to, like, touch it in an Agile environment. You want to touch people. You want to see their reactions. We do a lot of group-based interviews.
Mm-hmm.
We do pairing interviews. We can talk about this a little more later, but we even audition. Probably 50% of our interviews result in an audition where we invite someone to pair with us for a couple hours or something like that. We want to get some immersion into who these people are. How about you?
Well, you didn't answer the question, and it wasn't short.
Oh, man. So, small things. There are no keys. Our keys are face-to-face. We want face-to-face communication. We want to touch and feel folks. And the programmers, want to look at technology chops and show me what you can do. So we want people typing.
Right.
We want people jumping up at whiteboards. We do a lot of exploratory interviewing, so like thinking out of the box.
Right.
So we want to understand if you're an in-the-box thinker or an out-of-the-box thinker.
Right.
By example, we have design questions and things like that. But on the flip side, it's the soft skills. We're looking for someone who can take. We want to criticize someone in an interview,
right?
For example, I want to criticize their work.
Yes.
How can they handle that?
Yeah.
And do they handle that? And how do they respond? Right. And we actually have people who are criticizing them, and we have a group, and then we coach ourselves to look at body language. So the person in an interview pair, we pay a lot of attention to, like, not just what their words are, but how they're responding. We're not psychoanalyzing them, but I mean, this is an Agile team. It's really important for us to understand what you're about, what your personality traits are. Did that help a little bit more?
Yes, thank you.
Good. Sorry. How about you?
Fair enough. So, really, the two things that I try and tackle in the first. So, before I bring anybody in house, I have a 15-minute discussion, and it's really a dialogue. And the two big things that I'm after right off the bat are, why are they in software, right? I want somebody that it's what they do. It's what they live for. They found it. Their parents had a computer, and they found a basic book, and they were off and running, and they did this, and they never looked back.
So passion.
Right, so real passion for the craft, right? So that's step one. I don't want somebody that said, well, you know, I went to school and I wasn't sure what I was going to do, and I tried computer science because I heard you got paid pretty good, right? I'm like, okay, thanks for playing at that point. So I want somebody that really loves what they do and really wants to excel. And then the next step is what I'm trying to see is how they handle a difference. So a difference of opinion. I try and pull out or try and challenge them on something that they've said to see if they're going to back it up or if they're going to back down, right? And then I try and get them to challenge me in that same way and say, well, you know what? I don't think that's a good idea, right? So there'll be times where I'll just throw something out there that's
like
just
flat
wrong.
Like a stupid idea just to see how they react.
And then I don't want them to say, okay, you're the boss, whatever you say, exactly. Right? I don't want that, right? So those are the first two things that I look for, because those are the traits that I want to bring to our teams that I think can really make us.
Do you screen everyone then? So you're doing that as a first line screen?
Yes.
Okay.
So, but
would you trust that to your, you have managers or leads that report to you? Why don't you allow them to do that?
I don't know. Okay. Honestly, I think someday I would get there, but, I'm still working on training
them. I think it's evolutionary is what in talking to you, I think you're evolving your team. So
yeah,
I'm not challenging you, Josh. You had that look where like, crap, he's challenging. No, I'm not. But I'm wondering, you know, why have you not shared it?
Yeah. So it's a growth thing as, cause I have my core set of leads that I use to help me hire.
Yep.
So I'm working on growing them because they've never done this, yep. Right? So I'm trying to teach them, this is what I look for,
yep.
And trying to get what they look for and trying to merge that into one.
I think you're right on. I think it makes sense. And I'm not kowtowing to you, but it's part of the, I wanted to get that out, that I think the style, like I've delegated to my leads to do that. And I think they're learning, but we're in two different places in our team evolution. And then you bring them in for an on-site?
Yep. So I bring them in for on-site and I talk to them for another half hour, 45 minutes, and then bring in a couple of team leads at that point and let them hammer away. I do not let people ask syntactical questions, right? To me, that doesn't show that you're a good programmer. If you can tell me this keyword in this language versus this keyword in this language, what I need is problem solvers, right? Because at some point in their career working for me, I'm going to ask them to do something they've never done before, and I need them to not bat an eye and say, okay.
I mean, do you have a process that you've defined for this, like, you know, checklists of questions or question areas? And, you know, I have two interviews that we do. I have this kind of an interview and this. So you do the first line, then there's two follow-up. So is there a framework to your interviews? What is it?
There's a framework in my discussion. It piles on top of what we talked about in the phone screen. And then one of my favorite things to do is something that I learned in reading Joel on Software. It's called the impossible question, right? So it's a question that there's no way that you know the answer of. So it's that problem solving skills of Bob. If I ask you, Bob, what I need you to do is tell me the number of gas stations in the Triangle area. Right. And then what I want to do is see your reaction.
So just how I respond. It's we joke about it at work. We joke about Microsoft. Microsoft is notorious for asking those kind of open-ended questions as an early screen, like the number of ping pong balls that can fit into a 1967 VW.
Yeah, anything like that. Right?
Anything like that,
right? Something there's no way that you can know the answer, but I want to see how you break it down, decompose it.
How you attack the question, right?
Do you lock up, right? Or do you decide, hey, I'm going to do this? And it's tough with some of the younger generation is they instantly think, well, I've got my phone and I can go to Google and I can tell you in about 35 seconds, right? So getting them to put those resources away and think in their brain, because it's amazing where the first thing they think of is Google, right? And why? I can tell you that.
We have a session that our interview, I still want to hear your framework, but we have a complimentary session that we call problem solving. So we have a pair of we have a manager and engineers. So it could be a panel of anywhere from 2 to 3 to 4 people who, and then we have a 45 minute, I think, or an hour session where we talk about problem solving. So, and we talk about those open-ended sort of Joel on Software. We have one or two of those where we want to just know how you think. And then we have an open-ended design, like our common question we have is, designing a voting system, mm-hmm. like replacing the entire, you know, the U.S. voting system with a new electronic system. And what we want to do is, and we give them no requirements, right? So at all,
exactly.
We give no requirements, but it's a voting. Now we'll give them requirements along the way if they ask,
right.
But they have to ask for the requirements. And it's all about that whole hour is all about getting, sort of intimate with how they think, right? How they approach problems. So we're doing, I think, the same thing that you are.
Yeah, so that's kind of step one. Step two is one of my favorite things to do is get an insight into how they define great and not so great. So I ask them tell me the best team you've ever been a part of and what made them great, and tell me the worst team you've ever been a part of and why.
Oh, I like that question.
And then I do the same thing with developers, right? Of who's the greatest developer you've ever worked with and what made them great? Because I want to see, because to me, that kind of draws a picture of what they want to be and what they envision themselves kind of turning into.
Well, and their benchmarks, right? Yeah. I mean, if they look at the best developer on the planet as being mediocre from your point of view.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Right? It just gives you a data point to consider. I like that question.
And then, to me, the key, especially for hiring Agile, is when I ask them about the worst team they've ever been a part of, what I want to hear them say, without me asking, is what they did to try and make it better.
Yep.
When I have to ask, what did you do to make it better? That's, you know, negative item number one. When they say, well, I didn't really do anything, right? Then that's okay. You know, that's not really going to get it done. So those are two key things that really help me see what they're looking for and what they define as something truly special.
Yeah, I like that. I like the way there's a lot of commonality in what I'm hearing. How many interviews do you have, like sessions specific? Like how long is someone, if I would interview for a developer position, how long would I be in your building?
So you have the 20-minute phone screen with me, and then you have a 2-hour interview, part me, part my team leads, and that's it.
And then you would hire, you would make a quick... I've noticed nowadays, I used to put throat folks, I don't know if you I'm slightly older than you are, but we used to put people through like a day-long grill or something.
Yeah, that's what we did in my last job.
Did you? Yeah. Nowadays, folks seem to be like, not just you and I, but I think in general there's a trend towards trimming.
Right.
Down to like a half day or less. And the other thing we used to do years ago is have callbacks. So it was like interview one, then there was interview two. And so you might go through like 3 callback sessions or something like that while you're meeting different people.
Right.
But we have a one-shot. Well, mostly, the majority of what we do now is like a one-shot interview.
Yeah, and the one thing that I think we're kind of different on is I'm not huge on panels. I'm a 2-person max, right? I don't like 4 people.
Why?
I don't...
And again, I'm not challenging.
It doesn't feel... what I worry about is them connecting with those people. A big part is I want to see and feel the connection between those 2 people. And I think it's harder to get and feel that connection when it's spread across 4 in a 1-hour session, right? So I want to see those people having a dialogue, not answering questions and asking questions. So what I want to hear is I want to hear them talking and branching off into something or a movie or a book they read or something like that to try and get them to kind of fit and try and find that fit.
Yeah, I see what you're... I maybe exaggerate a little bit. Most of ours are pairs. So very, but we'll do panels depending on the position. It depends. You know, we try not to be entrenched about it.
Right.
But we always have good feedback. I mean, I've actually sat in on problem solving a few times as a chicken,
right,
if you will, just to see. And then I've come back with feedback. It's like, you know, we're way too esoteric, right? Yeah. It's like, and you guys, or we're waiting. You know, some people, when they freeze, like when we were doing one interview, and I think we, you know, sometimes silence is great, but I think someone was struggling and we let them struggle for like 10 minutes. Right at the board, later on, the feedback I had from the interview team was, you know, let's be merciful. Let's not let someone sweat bullets for 10 minutes.
Right,
and we were dialoguing, but we weren't really. You know how you can give someone like half of an answer or a third of it, and move them along a little bit so they're not just sweating bullets there. And we weren't doing that at all. We were just letting them sweat up there at the board.
Yeah,
and it was sort of merciless, I thought.
So there's,
but we do small teams. It's more smaller teams. I do think we do more questions, more panel-based, and so we are more panel-esque,
mm-hmm.
So your sense is right, and we do more firing line. One of the things I want us to do less of, it's a history for us, we do fire line questions.
What do you mean by that?
Meaning we just go question, answer. We don't have threaded conversations the way I would prefer that we do.
Right.
I generate personally threaded conversations.
Right.
I want that. I want a connection. It's our history, and it's something I inherited when I joined the company. We've softened it, but since it's our comfort zone, we will default back to, and I think it's very impersonal to have this fire in line question kind of thing going on. And we've gotten that feedback from our candidates as well. that it's sort of, even the ones we've hired, they're like, you know, we love the company, but you guys, you need to, you know, it's a little impersonal over here in the interview sequence.
So there's this theory that I subscribe to, and I've had discussions with other people that disagree. So we'll see what, I'm going to tell you which side I'm on.
Okay.
So there's the theory of when you're hiring a developer, you want to see them write code because you wouldn't hire a magician without seeing them do magic. So do you apply that principle, or do you believe it's hogwash?
We want to see code. So and I'm not sure if we're still doing this because I don't come into our website, but we used to, and I suspect we still do. We have like a 10, when you submit a resume to us, there's like 10 questions that we expect you to answer, and they're technology filter questions, and then some of them are contribution code. So we like to see some code coming in. We actually like to see code as part of our decision, like our pre-phone screen.
Right.
We want to see, I'm not talking about a lot, but technical questions that might have some code with it. Then depending on those answers, it's not uncommon for us to ask someone to bring code with them that we want to look at. It is not uncommon for us to ask folks, it's pretty common for us to ask folks to write code at a whiteboard.
Right.
In the interview process. So we have a problem solving. So we have two primary, we have management sessions like you do, sort of meet Bob Galen, right? And talk about, so that's the leadership stuff. We might have one or two or three sessions, depending, HR. So we have some peripheral sessions, and then we have two core technology sessions, 1 hour each. One is problem solving, which is sort of how are you attacking these open-ended questions, and then one for us is a technical interview. And in that case, we're looking for code. We've actually had people we have problems, and we've attacked. Like if someone's moving, we're a PHP shop. So it's pretty common for us if someone wants to transfer, like a Java developer wants to come into our shop, we're just looking to see how can they answer PHP questions, related questions. Would they do a little research offline on their own and answer a question? So we have sent them home with assignments after an interview and said, could you code this up? We'd like to see your coding chops as well. So we want to see code. So which side of the line are you on?
We are a whiteboard. I don't bring, I don't ask for questions up front or code up front because first job I ever was hired for,
you were scarred.
Yes.
I can tell. I can see it in your face. Yeah. My God, what did they do to you, man?
So get this. This is just so classic. Part of the application process was we want you to solve this problem in code and send it to us, right? And that's kind of what we do. Well, it turns out that was a section or that was a piece of an application.
Oh, don't tell me. No, they did not.
That had some flaw in it and they hadn't figured out how
to fix
it.
Oh, come on. So I thought you were going here. I was hoping you would.
They were farming it out to applicants and the one that got it right is the one they hired.
Shame on them.
Yeah.
Shame on that's. Expletive. That shame on them. That's terrible.
So I am permanently scarred by that.
Yeah. See, I thought there was something like that, and that would because I'm not stuck on it, but I think code has real value. But now I understand where you're. Yeah. Shame on them. No, that's not even funny. If anyone out there, you know, code that is just that's terrible. Like I've actually had even in pairing sessions. People have popped up bugs, and so, you know, can you fix this bug? Real bugs, production bugs, and try to get someone to fix it in a pairing session. And I'm like, no, we're not. This is an interview. This isn't slave labor. We're not trying to get free labor.
Exactly. So I do really believe in what I want to see is I want to see their code when they're thinking on their feet. So it doesn't have to be any language. It can be pseudocode. I'm not worried about syntax. You have the brackets in the right place, anything like that. So what I want my leads to do is to challenge them with a problem and say, how would you write this in code? It can be SQL. I don't care what it is, but solve it with code.
But that's what I want, and then you're leaning more toward me, because I would challenge you if you had no code. I mean, this is technology.
Right.
And so I want to see, there's talking and then there's doing.
Right.
And I want to see some doing. So we emphasize a lot of doing. We're adaptive. So depending on what we're sensing, it is... we're actually heavier on code after the interview sometimes. If we notice a weakness, if we have someone who we thought they were doing too much hand waving, then so we don't just send them a test, but we'll target it. We have a question and we're like, and we'll tell them that. But like the interview, you know, in the interview, we have these questions and we would, you know, could you please attack this problem for us because we're looking for more information.
Right.
And we get, I mean, it's not just the coding, Josh. There was a guy the other day, I think it was a Java developer. He self-learned PHP or an area of PHP and tooling. He answered, so not only was it the code, actually what impressed me the most, and we extended him out, we're hiring him, was the research he put in, the effort he put in to solve the problem
right.
in an area that he didn't know anything about. I don't care if he does Google or anything. This was on his time. And he like he over-delivered from right. my point of view. And I was like...
It puts a huge smile on your face, right?
I'm like, hire that man like now. And it was funny. This actually comes back to your passion point. So this is a real... I have to be careful about how I couch this. But then the manager in this case... came back and he says, yeah, but you know what? He's not that passionate. I'm not getting the passionate sense that we normally get because he has an MBA. He's like, oh, you know, he cares about business as much as he cares about programming. And he's got a broad background and he used to play in a band. So, oh, he's got, you know, he just doesn't like write code
right.
every hour of every, you know, he's a musician. And literally the manager, we're having this discussion, and then he told me this story about how he handled this coding assignment. And I'm like, you know, I said, I'm going to smack you. I'm like, you're getting caught up. And I think this is what I want passionate developer, but what is passion? Mm-hmm. And how do you measure it? And I think it's situational based on the person, right? And I think in this, you know, do you want folks that eat and sleep programming all the time? I don't know. So is everyone have to be like, is there a certain passionometer for folks? And I think not. I don't think right. that's what you were saying.
No. It's this is what I like to do when it's time to do it, right? You always worry about people that's all they do.
Yeah. Right? That's what I'm saying. And in this case, I mean, to me, if you're going to solve a problem like this, not only are you passionate about engineering and you're passionate about delivery, you're passionate about our company.
Right.
Right. You care. And we actually, you know, determined that. So we had this wonderful, like, conversation around, and I was like, if you pause one more second and don't extend an offer, you know, and I'm not trying to micromanage you. But we don't get these guys. We don't get folks like that all the time.
Right.
And read. So that comes into reading the this flexibility thing, turning into disruptors and stuff. I mean, do you have a core recipe, or is it sort of like what I'm saying, is you're sort of reacting to what you're seeing to people? So what are your key hire indicators?
Okay. So my recipe.
Yep.
Three pieces. I got this little Venn diagram right in the middle. It says, hire me. All right. So I want somebody that's smart. Somebody that gets things done, and somebody that's a team player.
Is that a Joel? That's a Joel on software.
That's a Josh on software.
Is it Josh on software?
Yeah, we should. If not, I'm going to call Joel and yell at him because he stole it.
So repeat that again. Let's get it. I'm going to get it again.
Smart. Gets things done.
Gets stuff
and
done.
And is a team player. And here's why. Because there's lots of smart people, right? And it's relatively easy to find the smart people. There's lots of smart people that never finish things, right? They have all these great ideas, but nothing ever comes out of it. There's no potentially shippable software.
Yep.
And then there's the people that are smart and get things done, but they don't play well with each other.
Yep.
Right? So those, I can't have somebody that sits in the cube and says, leave me alone, I'll come out when I'm done. Right? So those are the three key factors that when I'm hiring somebody, I want proof that they are all of those things. And I share that with my leads and I say, these are the things that we need to be successful. And I want them to ferret those out.
I like that. We have not a similar three thing. I don't know if they could map. And this comes from my boss, so I can't take credit for it. And it's at eye contact. It's currently where we're at. But Ralph, my boss, harps on this a lot. And I kid with him all the time about it, even in interviews. But it's attitude, aptitude, and skills. And we try to emphasize attitude and aptitude. And it's those soft skills of, you know, so attitude would map to getting stuff done,
mm-hmm.
right? You're about a can do. You're about a go forward. It's not about perfect software
right.
pros, right? It's about getting, to your point, getting stuff done. It's a business. Aptitude is thinking on your feet, not being stuck in your problem solving skills. And it's almost in that order. And we de-emphasize skills. So even though we're looking at code and things like that, and we're looking for, but we're looking for soft stuff first.
Right.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, because those are the things you can't teach. You can teach somebody.
That's exactly.
A really great developer will pick up a language in 2 weeks and be off and running.
Exactly.
But you can't take a great developer that can't work with somebody else. That's really hard to fix.
That's hard to fix. Yeah. We're exactly on the same page. Right. And we've seen that. We've hired these folks. I mean, so folks in the Metacast, if you don't think it matters, I mean, I have case study after case study after case study of folks. We've hired .NET folks. We're, like I said, we're PHP, and you know, the teams get all afraid. Oh, they don't know it. These folks have come in, and they've just had a wonderful, not overnight. It's hard work to make the language transition. But after, what, 2, 3, 4 weeks, suddenly we have, what, a PHP developer, but with someone with overwhelming chops, right?
Right.
An overwhelming attitude. It's just, the skill was a red herring, right? The programming language. And that's, I think, to your point. It's what do you focus on? I wanted to switch gears and talk about, you didn't react to it, and I threw it out there. I was sort of fishing a little bit, but auditioning, the notion of auditioning. So if you don't like coding, you were scarred there. What do you think about, you know, the sitting with people and actually doing work? There's a lot of folks, I'll preface it this way, there's a lot of folks in the Agile community that like to do, what, pairing as part of the interview process and get folks sitting down and at least pretending that they're, what, here's a couple hours of coding. The other part of auditioning might, if you're hiring an architect, actually get them, so there's a coding audition, if you will. There could be an architectural audition where you get someone to bring in the design they're most proud of in their history and to get up in front of a team for an hour and present that design and to have trade-off discussions.
Okay. So we do a mini audition, not a paired programming audition, but I did like that idea. I can't lie. It was an intriguing idea, but our audition is more on a design front of person gets up the whiteboard and say, this is what we need to do. And then it becomes a dialogue of then it's a team design at that point. So that's the audition route that we go. It's not of that length. It's probably, it ends up being about a half hour of that hour that the leads spend with them. So that's how we do it. We don't do the paired programming thing, but that's a potential add-on.
We've done that, and we don't do it, we don't do it by rote, but we've done that when we get a smell that's, we don't know if someone would deal well with the team. Someone wants, actually forget us, the candidate wants to look at code. We get a candidate who actually, you know, they sort of, you get a sense that they want more from the environment. They want a better understanding of our environment than just talking about the environment. They actually would like to sit down and we'll sort of say, hey, do you want to pair? Do you want to come back and pair, you know, to get a sense for the environment, to look at some real code, to debug a problem. And again, we're not trying to get free labor.
Right.
There's no free labor as part of it. But we do it more situationally, and we do it more. We do it more and more. I think lately. I hope we continue to do it and increase it. We do less of it. We have an opening for an architect now. I really hope we do an audition for the architect. And it's not what you're talking. We do what you're talking about. I think there's a big difference between the design, you know, this collaborative design whiteboard work. To me, that's part of our design interview, and having someone actually formally present something, it puts a different spin on things for them. Like, think about you interviewing for a management position, and I asked you as an audition to come in and explain, you know, your hiring processes, the evolution of your team over the last 2 years.
Right.
In a succinct way. I want 15 minutes of a presentation, then 15 minutes of Q&A on how have you strategically attacked your organization in improving it, what's worked and what hasn't, and I really want an equal balance, and what are you doing about it?
No, that's great.
Right. And that to me would be sort of that audition, the nature of that audition. You don't want to give them a 2-week assignment or something like that. But you want it to be meaty. You want to see how they handle what. Like, from your point, I want to see how a manager, I mean, you're going to be under pressure day to day.
Right.
So how do you handle that?
Right.
I'd actually love to do that to you, right?
We could do that as a Metacast.
We could do that as a Metacast. Nah, that's probably too dangerously aligned with our day jobs, though.
Probably.
It probably is. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Joanna Rothman, you name-dropped Joanna Rothman has written a book. I have it here in the office on hiring. Her last name is Rothman, R-O-T-H-M-A-N. And she talks, it's a good book. It's a good generic book on recruiting technology folks. And she is a strong proponent of various forms of auditioning, mm-hmm. again, in a sane way, in a humane way, not really busting people's chops. But, and I think auditioning in agile teams is more and more relevant. If I had my druthers, I'd probably, and let's talk about contract to perm. So part of it is how do you interview permanent folks and then how do you interview contractors? To me, part of it is more and more we're attracted to contract to perm, mm-hmm. if we can get those folks, because the first few weeks is an audition.
Right.
Right.
And it's a two-way street,
It's absolutely a two-way street. Right. Absolutely.
Yeah, so that's a big sell because that's how we work. We are contract to perm, and a lot of people are concerned about that. But I really push it because I came in the same way, right? And it really was an audition on both sides of the table. I could really decide, is this a company I want to spend X number of years with?
Or so would you interview differently? I bet the answer is yes. So if you were doing perms, would you adjust a little bit?
As opposed to contract to perm?
Yeah.
No. I would treat those the same because I want them to be the same person, and if that's how we work, that's how we work.
But would you extend the interview? See, because there's a difference, and we should share with the Metacasters. There's a real distinct difference in, because we're looking for perms.
Right.
And you're looking, predominantly the entry in your environment, if I recall, is contract to perm.
Yes.
Right? That's the primary interview. Rarely do you interview a permanent person for your, that's the entry into the company. So try it if you like. Try it and then buy it.
I treat them the same way.
We are absolutely perm.
I treat both the same way because when I hire somebody, contract to perm, I expect them to be there for the long haul. I don't hire somebody. I have been burned many times on not trusting my gut, right? So if I have a concern about somebody, I don't go with them. I've settled before and it's been a mistake. So if I want to hire somebody that I expect, when I hire a contract to perm, I expect to convert them. So
but would you,
it's not a trial. I really believe in this person.
So I'm not, what I'm saying is it's not would you, I'm saying, would you extend something? Not would you, right? So I'm not pushing fairness or equity or anything like that. But if it's a perm versus,
more
a,
in depth?
Would you go more in depth? Is more? Would you extend? It's not. Would you?
No.
Would you change? So you wouldn't extend a darn thing.
No.
Okay.
See, you would.
I might in that case, right? I might because you don't. There's a significant. So to me, that's where I'm leading to auditioning or even some pairing in that environment. If I'm in a contract versus a perm environment, to me, I might step up and have an additional hang out with the team or something like that, step like that.
Right.
Where because again, you have no, it's much easier to part ways on the contract perm side if you make a mistake. I'm not assuming,
right, yeah,
than it is on the perm side.
Yeah, it is, but I don't want to make a mistake, right? So I'm going to do it the same way.
Don't misread me. I take recruiting this. You and I have the same philosophy there,
yeah.
Right? I don't like, you know, if we do lunch, we do lunch with them. If we sell, we sell.
Right.
I have the same view. I'm looking long term. I've actually in one case we did just as an exception. We actually brought one person in contract to perm because we had some nagging issues, and it was driven from. So we were interviewing them for a perm, but we had some nagging doubts about sort of their soft skills, but we knew they were just nagging things from their history. And we had some folks who had worked at other companies with them. And we had brought them in just one person as a contract to perm. And we converted them almost immediately. It was like, and we opened, you know, we would have probably said no on the perm side, but they were just such an excellent candidate. We said, can we have a trial here? Do you accept the risk and we'll accept a little risk?
Yeah, I've been burned, and so just the same thing with the smells in Agile. If I get a smell,
you'll skip it.
Yeah, I just
see. But this case, and I'll put it up. I'm not arguing with you, but in this case, we had a smell. It was a light smell. I'm not talking about Jack the Ripper, right? Right. I'm not talking about incompetent Bob, right? I'm talking about a very lightweight smell that we would have determined very quickly, and it resolved itself.
Right.
It was like because we didn't. They were in a position where they had been burned a few times.
Yeah.
So it was a baggage smell. Are they going to bring their baggage to us?
Yeah.
And that was a case where you would naturally discover that pretty quickly.
Right. Yeah. And a lot of that comes from the nature and the size of the teams that I was hiring for at my previous job. It was a much smaller company. So when I would bring somebody in and we would go from 7 to 8, right, that's a large part of the team that they have to be able to make a difference, right? And if they end up being a drag, it's a drag on a very large chunk of the org, right? And that was something I couldn't handle. Whereas now with larger teams, it's something that's a little bit more palatable, but I still have kind of like that from my first job, right? I've got that bad taste in my mouth where I just try and avoid it if I can.
I think hiring and recruiting is one of those black art kind of things where your history inevitably colors how you adapt, and I think that's healthy, right? Yeah. It certainly colors mine. My mistakes certainly color my thinking as well. And I mean, I've made recruiting mistakes, and they're a nightmare. So maybe that's something to leave. I mean, so do you? You know, going with your gut. You didn't directly say it, but
I trust the gut.
Trust the gut.
Yeah.
Pound it. Yeah. Right. No. I trust my gut. There, two or three of the worst hires I ever made in my life, my gut was saying no. Everyone around me, yeah. And my little gut was telling me something. And one of them, and all kidding aside, I hired someone with multiple personalities, and I swear to God, it was a disaster. And my gut, and we couldn't detect it at all. And trust me that letting, you know, firing someone, letting someone go who has multiple personalities as an engineer is a really hard thing to do.
I can imagine.
Right. And that was the clarifying factor for me, for my gut. I'm like, I'm going to trust my gut.
Yeah. And I think we've all had that one mistake that we've said,
oh my God,
gosh, I knew I shouldn't have done that, but I did anyways, and I'm never going to do it again.
But it's intangible. It's like, it's hard for engineers. I think it's hard for us to rationalize, you know, with the gut, because it's an intangible.
Right.
And we like hard data.
Right.
Right, but no, I think that's, if there's a couple keys out of this Metacast, I think trust your gut is one of them.
Yeah,
is a key one. So beyond trusting our gut, I wanted to wrap up. We're running out of time, but like hiring key people. So do you hire the best of the best of the best? So do you reserve? So what does good enough look like? So there's just in time. There's lean principles: just in time and just enough and good enough. How does that relate to your hiring? Maybe that's the final point that we want to talk about.
That's a tough one, right? So I really want to believe that I've got the best of the best of the best, right? Or the best that have come across my table, because you can't not hire, right? You'd be looking forever. But to me, it's a difference maker. Is it a difference maker? Is it somebody that's going to make our patterns and practices better? Is it somebody that's going to make our team better? It's going to make our attitude better? Anything like that. I want game changers, right? That's what I'm looking for. And there's all different flavors, right? There are game changers that don't even know they're a game changer yet, right? And then there's game changers that know, hey, I can come in and make this difference. So there's a whole spectrum. And if I really believe that somebody's going to come in and make a difference, I'm on board with them.
But I think you're a driver. So I have seen companies, I have the notion or the term unicorn, where companies get stuck looking for a unicorn and they never find it,
right?
Or another thing is they look for themselves. So you can be looking for yourself and never find yourself, because you're the only one who is you, or a team that is looking for itself. So you're looking for the mirror, or you're looking for a unicorn. And I think both of those are sort of fool's errands, right? There's this decisiveness of, you know, I have 10 resumes, I have some good ones, let's bring them in. Are they a difference maker? And then let's get them on board now.
Right.
And let's move forward.
Yeah.
Rather, you strike me that way.
Yes.
Yeah. So I think the anti-pattern here is getting stuck.
Right.
Right. Getting stuck looking.
Because I've been there, right? Because I've had an open position for 4 months, and I saw the damage that it did.
Yep.
Right. So I've made that mistake, right? I've not trusted myself. I've tried to find that person, and it cost us.
Absolutely. I mean, we were looking for ourselves. So I've had both experiences over the last 3 or 4 years. In permanent positions, in leadership positions, we were looking for unicorns, and golly gee willikers, we never found the darn things, right? And we were open for a year. I mean, we had a unicorn for a year, for God's sakes. It was stupid. And it's like, adjust your rack and move on, right? Because you need to, if you have an open rack, you have a need, fill the need.
Right.
And then the other thing we look for is ourselves. And, you know, we look for, you know, that's, you know, dockers. So if you're in a Docker environment, people with button-down shirts, you know, blue shirts, you know, khaki pants, Docker, the belt's all the same color, you know, walking, talking, the same. Everyone's from the Northeast. They're from the Boston area or something like that, and they have skills in this area. You're looking for freaking robots or something, or what, clones of yourselves.
Right.
And that's, and you never find them, and you never will find them. So both of those things, I think are anti-patterns. It's like move. And trust your team to what mold. You don't know. We new hires, we throw them into our teams.
Right.
We don't do a lot of grandiose training and stuff. And what happens is, you know, with our prep, with that sort of that, you know, the way that I set the stage of, I want you to come in and really make a difference, and then throwing folks in our teams and letting the teams assimilate them and them with the team. So let it, trusting the self-directed team notion of getting that person, you know, ramped up works really nicely for us.
Yep.
I think we're out of time.
We are out of time.
All right. This was a great topic, Josh.
This was good.
Right.
A good last minute topic.
Well, and I learned some things from you in recruiting style, and it's one of those things that I think, independent of your experience, it's something that we, you know, we're active on.
Right.
Right. We're, as leaders, we're active on. So I like the Metacast. I learned quite a bit from you. So thank you for sharing.
Thank you. I learned one thing from you.
I'll take one. I usually bat zero. So
you're on the board. Right?
I'm feeling really perky right now. Right? I'm on the board.
I'm not as complimentary as Bob. I should be,
but you're not.
That's what I should learn from this Metacast.
Yeah, but you're not. So from beautiful downtown, we're in Cary, North Carolina this morning, and you've been listening to the Metacast, and I. Think we, what, how do we wrap it? We look for feedback. So please give us feedback, comments, topics.
Yes, all of that can be done at www.meta-cast.com. That's the actual hyphen between the A and the C. On Twitter, we're at meta-cast. That's all spelled out again because Twitter doesn't like non-alphanumeric characters. So that's us. Let us know what you like, what you don't like. We even have some comments now. Thank you to Alex out there.
Yep.
Letting us know.
So you can comment to the Metacast, give us feedback. We love it. Let us know if we made a difference in either direction. Let us know if you disagree. And we want to thank you for listening. For that one listener out there, we appreciate your ear greatly. So for Bob Galen.
And Josh Anderson.
Shake.
And bake.
Y'all take care.
See ya. Y'all?